So my topic may be a little obscure, but I hope it's less so when we're done. The talk really has three parts. One is how I think about the business of trying to figure out causal structure from imaging data, and a discovery, not my discovery, but due to Judah Pearl, who will talk this afternoon here. Deseparation. Part two is about a machine learning literature which I suspect is alien to most of you, but which I think bears on your enterprise. And part three is a kind of examination of methods that I find are routinely used to make causal conclusions or hypotheses in the imaging literature and some of their problems. So, my picture of trying to use imaging data to figure out how the brain produces complex behavior is that it's sort of like auto mechanics. In auto mechanics, we've got parts. The big parts have littler parts. The parts relate to one another. You get the normal effect if the parts act in the right sequence in the right times, and otherwise you get something wrong. Traditional 19th century cognitive neuropsychology was essentially a kind of reverse auto mechanics when something has broken some of the parts. Now, it seems to me that if you think about the enterprise of trying to figure out what regions of the brain cause what other regions of the brain and what sequences to produce various kinds of complex behavior, then you've got some overall goals. One is to identify the parts that are relevant to the behaviors, and secondly, to figure out how they influence one another and in what sequences. So, if we're talking about imaging data, we're talking about identifying relatively big parts. Even a voxel is relatively big parts. The typical ROIs are often a lot of voxels. And then trying to figure out how they influence one another in what sequences. So those are how I conceive the goals. One can have different goals, of course. One can have an entirely different picture of how the brain works, but that's the one I'm going to talk about today. So the idea is that we somehow want to move from time series data, essentially, and these, of course, aren't fMRI time series, they're something I took off the web to illustrate time series. We want to move from time series data where the series are often subject to shocks, that is to say some stimulus has been given and you get a response. We want to move from that to some high level, relatively high level understanding of the causal mechanism by which the behavior is produced, or at least some aspects of that mechanism. We don't expect to get the whole, but we expect to get something. And everybody everywhere in every domain, at least on their napkins, represents causal hypotheses by diagrams like this, which are directed graphs. That is, say you've got a set of vertices and you have directed edges between the vertices, and there's a kind of intuitive interpretation which we often rely on. Namely, wiggling X will wiggle Z, which will wiggle W, at least for some values of Y, and similarly, wiggling Y will wiggle Z, which will wiggle W. But if you were somehow to reach in and hold Z fixed so it couldn't change, then wiggling X wouldn't change wiggling W unless there's some other connection between them not represented in the diagram. That's informally, at least, quite familiar stuff, and it fortunately has a very nice and very useful mathematical formalization. So that works pretty well for our automobile, yeah? So here's the braking system, and you can sort of abstract away relevant variables. You push the brake, that affects the fluid level in the master cylinder. That affects, depending on whether you've got a pad or a shoe, it affects the fluid in the caliper or the fluid in the wheel cylinder, which produces frictions either in the shoe or against the rotor, which makes the vehicle decelerate. I mean, this is sort of stuff an auto mechanic would know, and presumably those of you who fix your own brakes know as well. Now, When the moment one says the word causality, one gets philosophical objections. And I haven't heard any because, of course, I have a microphone, but undoubtedly some are in some of your heads. So let me go quickly through a few standard ones. Cause is a vague metaphysical notion. I think that's true. But compare probability. Nobody knows what we're talking about. If you think otherwise, we've got a long conversation. Probability may be an enchaot notion to interpret, but at least it has a well-defined and shared mathematical structure that's been understood pretty well since Kolmogorov, and even before that was reasonably well understood. Causation doesn't. Well, I want to refer you to some works. One is Peter Spurdy's book Causation, Prediction, and Search, which is now 15 years old. Another is Judea Pearl's book Causality, but even more I want to urge you to come listen to Pearl's talk this afternoon if you don't think there's a mathematical structure to causality. There's another kind of objection, and that's that what we are dealing with when we talk about causation between Royce's epiphenomena. The real causes are at the synaptic level, so talk of causal relations amongst aggregated regions or clusters is nonsense. And Carl Friston expresses this view emphatically, if cryptically, in his statistical parametric mapping. For many, this rhetoric represents a category error because causal is an attribute of the state equation. Well, if you think that macroscopic causal attributions don't make sense when there's an underlying mechanism on which the aggregate variables supervene, then you better get rid of virtually all of our causal talk in the universe and the sciences, except when we're doing fundamental physics. And there, we don't know what causality means. So smoking causes cancer seems to me to make pretty good sense, but obviously it supervenes on a lot of molecular details. Human activities cause global temperature increases. It doesn't seem to me nonsense, but of course it's about big aggregate phenomena and so on. So I think the philosophical objections are untenable. Let's see what we can do substantively. So I want to talk about how you get from systems of equations representing implicitly causal hypotheses to graphical models. So let's start with a system of equations. These are linear equations from a recent paper, and of course I have no idea what these are. They are names for variables in regions of interest in an fMRI study. The epsilons are noise terms, and typically with linear models, their noise terms are assumed to be independent. A, B, C, and D are linear parameters to be estimated. The other things are variables. And this is not a deterministic system because the noise terms. If you just look at the relations between med FGB and sing B and so forth, those aren't deterministic because the unobserved noise terms. If you took the noise terms into account explicitly, then of course it would be a deterministic system. And Hansen turns a system of equations like this into a directed graph, and you can find this kind of stuff in structural equation modeling all over the place. But I just want to point out that there is a graphical structure. The graphical structure corresponds to the functional form of the equations. So IPLB depends on STGB, depends on SINGB, but there's no equation in which IPLB depends directly on MED, even though they are, of course, correlated according to the model. So the structural equations, so-called, separate out what's supposed to be cause and effect, but the actual representation is much clearer in the graphical model. Now, the parameters there are Hansen's estimates of the linear coefficients. Of course, I don't believe them for a moment, but that's neither here nor there. But you see, Here's the point. This is standard sort of graphical picture for a linear model. The graphical picture actually doesn't depend on the linearity. It doesn't depend on the distribution assumptions. These things are usually assumed to have normal variance. No such assumption. We could get the same graphical picture from any functional dependencies that have the same formal structure. An arbitrary function f, an arbitrary function g, an arbitrary function h. It would make no difference. We would get the same graphical structure representing the hypothetical causal relations. So if we abstract, abstraction helps sometimes. Sometimes it just takes you to nothing. Sometimes, if we abstract just the functional form of dependencies, so what depends on what, through what else, we get a directed graph, and the graphical level isn't particular to normal distributions, to linear relations, to non-interactive variables. It's completely general. Now, so what? Some things that are completely general are completely useless. Well, this generalization is not useless because the graphical structure captures the independence and the conditional independence relations that are implied by any hypothesis with any distribution on the noise terms that preserves the independence of the noises for any functional form of the dependencies. So in particular, this graph implies that med GIB is independent of the set of variables, that is to say, each variable in the set, SPGB, PIPLB, conditional on SingB. This is the standard representation I will use. This stylus with an underlined double stylus represents independence. The single stylus is a conditioning bar, and we're talking about the independence of these variables conditional on any value of these variables. These independence relations are encoded by the graph. Now, why is that interesting? Because almost all of our tests for models are tests of independence or conditional independence or their consequences. If you do a test of differences of means, you're doing a test of a consequence of an independence hypothesis. Almost all of our tests, in one way or another, derive from the assumption, some null hypothesis about independence or conditional independence or its consequences. So capturing independence and conditional independence in a simple abstract structure that is generic is of value if, in fact, you know something, if you know how to get from the abstract graphical structure to the independence relations. And there's a code. Judeo Pearl and his students essentially discovered the code in a book published now 20 years ago in 1988. The code is called deseparation. Actually, it was discovered independently by several people. I'll give you Pearl's version, but Stefan Lauritsen in Sweden, well, now he's in Oxford, discovered it independently in a different equivalent form. So let's look at this structure. If I tell you, okay, I have got a probability distribution for variables that are related with independent noises for each variable, and the functional dependencies, what variables depend on what other variables, are given by this directed graph, can I determine the conditional independence relations that follow just from the graphical structure alone? Well, X is independent of Z or W, conditional on Y. And you can see that basically the only source of any connection, the only track, as we call it, between X and W is through Y. You condition on Y, that's essentially like controlling for Y, and it makes X and W independent. Similarly, X and W are independent conditional on Z alone. And now, here's something interesting. X is not independent conditional of W conditional on R. That might strike you as unsurprising. If I condition on R, there's still this pathway between X and W, this source in X that would produce an association between X and W, so conditioning on R seems irrelevant. But suppose I condition on R or I condition on S, and I also condition on Z and Y. So by conditioning on Z and Y, I break that upper association between X and W. I'm essentially holding Z and Y constant. They don't vary, so they're not going to produce a covariation between X and W. But if I condition on R or I condition on S, X and W become associated. Conditioning on the common effect of two variables creates an association between them. And this rather banal remark, which we could justify intuitively, but which is just analytically immediate, is the key to a whole lot of misunderstanding and misapplication of methods. So the sort of rule of thumb is that conditioning on a variable on a directed path between X and W, or two variables, blocks the association produced by that path, but conditioning on a variable that's a common effect of X and W creates an association. Turns out that the same rules that govern graphs like this, which are acyclic, there aren't any pathways that go back to themselves, also covers cyclic graphs. My colleague Peter Spertes proved that about a decade ago for linear systems. It doesn't necessarily do it for linear systems. So there's actually an algorithm, and I'll briefly tell it. If you've got a graph and you want to know what are the independence and conditional independence relations implied, in fact, here's what you do. Every time you write down some formal model, yeah, abstract away, look at the directed graph, and apply the following rules. If there's a path between two variables, that would say any sequence of adjacent variables with the edges going in any direction, all higgledy-piggledy, yeah? And the set of variables you're conditioning on doesn't include any non-collider, any variables going in the same direction. That is to say, any case where two edges aren't coming into the same variable. So you're not conditioning, you're not breaking a connection by conditioning on things going in the same direction or coming from a common source. And if there is a collider on the path, two edges going into each other, that collider variable is either in the set you're conditioning on, or there's a directed path from it to one of the variables you are conditioning on. If that's the case, if there is such a sequence of edges, then the variables are associated conditional on the set, I've called it Q, that you're conditioning on. Well, that's a bit unintuitive to get in a quick lecture, but I just wanted to make it clear that there actually is an algorithm. So, what's the point of having this? We can exploit this general property, deseparation, in conjunction with distribution assumptions to actually search for graphical causal structure. Because we don't need particular parameter estimation. We don't have to go through the procedure, what's the value of the linear coefficient? We don't have to assume any particular parameterization, we just need general distribution assumptions, and we represent our hypotheses by directed graphs. We can search over directed graphs. Computers are good at searching over directed graphs. And once we find a directed graph, we can fit a parametrized model to it and estimate the parameters. So we do it in two stages. Searching for the graphical structure, estimating the parameters that go with that graphical structure, if you assume a particular functional decomposition. Secondly, we can understand where data analysis goes wrong, because if you do something in the manipulation of your data from imaging that changes the conditional independence structure in a relevant way, you're going to change the probability distribution. You're going to get misestimations about what is dependent on what. So you can take one and the same marginal distribution, and you take one graphical model and estimate a parameter, and you take another graphical model and estimate a parameter, you'll get completely different judgments about whether one variable has an effect on another or not. It's essential that you get the dependency structure represented by the directed graphical structure correct in your model, or else a lot else can be nonsense. So how is it, from the machine learning literature, we can actually search over graphical models. So remember, we're abstracting up to this conditional independence structure. We're going to search over graphs representing it. Different graphs can, of course, have the same conditional independence structure, so the most we're going to be able to discover is an equivalence class relation. We're going to find alternatives, not a unique solution, generally. Sometimes we get a unique solution, but not generally. So we're going to search over these graphs. If we find a graph, then we make whatever substantive assumptions we want to make about the parametric family, and we do standard maximum likelihood or your favorite Bayesian parameter estimation. So let me show you how one of these algorithms works. This is the simplest and first algorithm. Goes back to 1991, actually. So suppose the truth structure looks like this. Now, if you're used to linear models, just interpret it linearly. W depends on Y, Y depends on X, and Z. So if you had a system of equations going like this, you would have W is equal to AY plus noise, and Y is equal to BX plus ZZZ plus noise. And then you'd make some distribution assumptions on the noise variables and know where you'd be. But now suppose all you see is the values of X, Y, and Z, and W. You don't know anything about this structure, and you want to find it. So there are some consequences of this structure. X is independent of Z, and X and Z are independent of W, conditional on Y. So here's the method. Suppose we have data and we can actually identify these conditional independence relations. You start with this data object, which isn't a hypothesis, it's just a data object. You make it up, the computer makes it up. It's a complete undirected graph. If any two variables in the graph are independent, or uncorrelated, if you're assuming normal distribution, you remove the edge between them. So here, X and Z are simply independent, so this edge will be removed by the procedure. Yeah? And once you've done that, you ask for any guys that remain, are they independent, conditional on any third variable that's next to one or the other? So, in fact, what do we have? We have that X is independent of W, conditional on Y, and that Z is independent of W, conditional on Y. And so we get rid of two edges, and we're left with this skeleton. Actually, it's the skeleton of the truth. Now, I won't go through the rationale, but I'm not making this up. It's provable that you can uniquely orient this graph from these conditional independence relations. There's only one graph in the deseparation equivalence class that's equivalent to the graph that represents these independencies, and that's it. And so, when you apply an algorithm due to Chris Meek at Microsoft, you get the truth back. Okay, that's a very stringent set of assumptions. We've assumed, for example, that there are no unmeasured common causes. Yeah, we didn't allow any extra factors to be playing there. We assumed the system was acyclic. We assumed that our data provided us with simultaneous measurements of all the variables. We didn't measure one set of variables on this side of the room and a different set of variables on this side of the room. We made a lot of assumptions. And one of the things that's gone on in the last 20 years in machine learning is work on What happens when you weaken these assumptions? What can you learn? What can you prove you learn? Well, first of all, I want to point out that there's a Bayesian version of this search procedure. It's asymptotically equivalent. It gives the same results in a large sample limit. It will sometimes give different results in the short run, and we, from lots and lots of years of experience, tend to prefer it to the algorithm I just illustrated. Basically, it starts with an empty graph. It adds or changes the edges that most increase the fit, where the fit is essentially just the posterior probability, and it iterates. And as I said, in the large sample limit, you get the same results as with the PC algorithm that I just described. And this algorithm was developed really by Chris Meek in his doctoral thesis at Carnegie Mellon in the mid-90s, but it was proved correct by his colleague and him, Max Tickering, a couple of years ago. Now, in general, when your data are confounded with unrecorded variables, or when you badly measure things, so that the conditional independence relations that you find amongst your measured variables don't reflect the causal structure very well, inference is harder. But there are algorithms. The only semi-feasible one is the fast causal inference algorithm. It's actually extremely slow, but it was called fast because it was faster than the only other algorithm, which will... It'll do two things. If there is possible confounding, it won't jump to a conclusion. And secondly, in some cases, it will identify that there is confounding. It won't tell you the names of the variables that are missing. Yeah, it won't tell you the structure of their relations, but it will tell you what variables they confound. So let's take a look at this example, where there's some variable that isn't in our data set whose variation causes a covariation of y and z, but y and z are respectively influenced by x and w as well, that have been recorded. What the FCI algorithm will produce with data from this structure, that is to say the observed data, not the unrecorded guys, is it will say, all right, I can't tell whether x is a direct cause or a confounded cause. I can't tell whether W is a direct cause or a function, but I can tell you that Y and Z have unmeasured common cause. And the FCI algorithm is a consistent estimator of structure, that is to say, in a large sample limit, it is correct. It is often uninformative. Often you get so many alternative structures that you're not happy. Now, what happens if the data are separated? So we measure a bunch of variables here, we measure a bunch of variables here, and it turns out there's a variable we measured here that we didn't measure there, and the variable we measured there we didn't measure here, or more than one. Yeah? So in my example, let's suppose that W got measured on this side of the room, and R got measured on that side of the room. So our data sets really look like this. R is missing over here, and W is missing over here. There's no case where we measured both W and R. We don't have any such case in our data set. We can't determine their correlation. Nonetheless, you can reconstruct this structure uniquely, and you can do so for many other structures. There's an algorithm due to David Danks, our student Rob Tillman, and myself that recovers the structure from the marginal distributions where there are omitted variables in some of the distribution in some of the samples. In many cases, it will give you lots of alternative models rather than a unique one. I chose this because it's cute. You always want to put your best foot forward. The same methods can be used for specifying the structure of time series methods, time series models, rather. In time series models, at least structural time series models, structural bars, as they're sometimes called, You want to see which variables depend on which other variables at various lags. And you hope or assume after testing that the time series is stationary so that the probability distribution looks the same through time for the noise variables at least. And then you can apply various methods. Regression is the usual method, but in fact you can apply the greedy equivalent search, the Bayesian search, or PC algorithm. You could even apply FCI to this procedure. And you get a structural VAR model. What about latent variables? What about, one of the things is we're always essentially measuring, at least in Friston's view, stuff which is, and I think that's quite reasonable, stuff which is sort of indirect. Well, I'm not sure this ever applies to fMRI. The other stuff might. But in fact, it is possible to discover latent structures under assumptions very much like those I've talked about heretofore. So suppose the true structures like this, T1, T2, T3 haven't been recorded. The M's all have been. As you can see, the structure is in fact confounded. There's a direct influence here. T3 and T2 influence a common variable. There's a confounding here, and T1 and T2 influence. So it's kind of a mess. Not a complete mess, but kind of a mess. Turns out there's an algorithm, in these cases, for clustering the variables so that you throw away, it locates the confounded variables and eliminates them. And the result is you have clusters that are unconfounded in the sense that the variables within the cluster share an unmeasured common cause and no other common causes. When you do that, you get, for sufficiently good samples from data like this, you get rid of M4 and you get rid of M7 and M8, and you're left with three clusters. Those come out automatically. You don't have to choose them. You don't have to specify how many clusters. The data determine them. If everything's confounded, you're going to get nothing. So label them. You know, the computer doesn't know their true names, but let's label them. And now let's apply one of the search algorithms, say the Bayesian GES search, to estimates of the covariances of T2, T3, and T1. Turns out you can estimate those, and you can estimate them consistently from the unconfounded variables. That's the whole point of the clustering, to enable the estimation of the associations amongst the latent variables. With those associations, you can determine the dependency structure amongst them. And in particular, you can determine that T3 separates T2 and T1. In this case, you can't, with this method, determine the directions of the edges. You essentially are getting an equivalence class of structures for the latent variables. Now, one of the things we don't know is whether we can apply this latent variable method to time series. Let me tell you some of the limits of these methods. One of the limits is that the independence relations on which these methods directly or indirectly depend don't determine unique models. In particular, there are often guys that have big sets of guys that have the same set of independencies. So if you take a complete graph, any way you can orient the edges produces the same independencies, that is to say, none. So in a case like that, not very informative. These are all equivalent in their deseparation of relations and thus in the conditional independence relations models based on them imply. So we can apply algorithms like PC, FCI, GES. They're asymptotically consistent. They give correct information almost surely in the large sample limit, assuming no undirected, unobserved causes with PC and GES. But you can allow that. You can allow unobserved causes with FCI and with the ION algorithm. They often don't give us all the information we want. Now, there are procedures that have appeared in the last 3 years which break down those equivalence classes and enable us to make finer inferences in a big class of cases. They're not as general as the procedures I've talked about, but they are general enough to be of interest to fMRI modeling. They work for linear systems where the noise terms are not normally distributed, where they're not Gaussian. Now, in fact, that's a great deal of the world until you start smoothing things, right? So we've seen this structure. It's deseparation equivalent to a whole lot of different structures. We saw them on the previous slide. It entails the same condition of dependence relations as all those other structures. But the Lingam algorithm, which appeared, I think, first in 2005, 2006, uses independent components analysis and some clever algebra, really, to break apart the equivalences. And the basic, I'm not sure how much detail I should give here. If you've got a system of simultaneous linear equations here, they can always be written in terms of the noise terms. That's what econometricians call the reduced form of the equations. But the econometricians are always making up new names for things so that they can get more Nobel Prizes. But the point is, if you look at this, this is all the variables written in terms of their noises. The X terms depends on its noise alone, Y depends on its noises, and X noises, Z depends on everybody's noises. Yeah? So if we wrote that as a graphical model, it would look like this. And these are independent by assumption. Yeah? These are the noise terms. They're independent. Independent components analysis is a technique, has been known since the 70s, there are a lot of algorithms for it, for identifying independent sources of noise for a system of measured variables in linear systems. Wow, that's just what we got. So if you can identify the sources of noise, and you can identify which of your measured variables depend on which of the sources, you have a partial ordering here. X depends only on EX, Y depends on EX and EY, Z depends on CX. So you discover this, you can discover this, and you can discover which way the causal relations go. Damned if it doesn't work. Okay, feedback systems. The brain is supposedly, I don't know much about brains, but the brain is supposedly filled with them, yeah? Well, can you search over feedback systems? We would represent those. If we didn't represent them by time series, we'd represent them by directed graph. And here's one. And there are actually two methods. One's been in the literature for almost a decade by Thomas Richardson in the Department of Statistics at the University of Washington. And Peter Spurdy's, it uses conditional independence relations. A new method just published this year uses a modification of Lingam, and they find what is a deseparation class or better using Lingam methods for cyclic graphs. So it turns out these two graphs are equivalent. Any probability distribution this guy supports, this guy supports. So that's the best you can do without getting in and wiggling things. All right. Now, none of the machine learning methods I've talked about, to the best of my knowledge, have been used with imaging data. Instead, we have basically a conjecture and test methods. That is to say, people form models and they test them. We have regression methods. Granger causality for time series, and exhaustive testing of all linear models. Those are pretty much the strategies I've found in the literature. Why the machine learning techniques have not been tried. I take it there are a couple of reasons. One is unfamiliarity, although many of them are not new. Disciplines make literatures almost orthogonal. And the other reason is some of them at least don't tell people all that they want to know. Yeah? They tell them what the data can possibly determine under sets of assumptions. That may be less than one wants to conclude. So I want to go through just very quickly a litany of possible errors about causal inference that without making attributions, one can find in the literature. One is pooling data from different subjects. So you take Shlomo and you take Igor and you put their runs together and you apply your methods to them. Well, there's an old result. It's maybe the oldest disappointing result about causal inference in literature. It's due to George Udny Yule back in 1904. And that is that if I take this group and this group, and I take two variables here and two variables here, and they are independent in this group, there's no association, and they're independent in this group. And while they're independent in both groups, they have both of them, both of the variables, a different distribution here than here. But the same, so think about random effects models where you have different linear parameters for different subjects. Yeah? That would be just such a case. If you mix them together, pool them, the variables are now dependent, almost sure. So you can produce associations that don't have any causal significance except that association detects the fact that you mix the samples together. But other than that, it's not telling you anything. You can get this by pooling data across subjects. You can get it in non-stationary time series by pooling the time series, taking the time series events as separate cases. There are things people seem to do in the fMRI data routinely that eliminate opportunities that the machine learning literature affords. So in particular, we do various things, sometimes for very good reason. If you remove autocorrelation, for example, by regression within a time series, and then you look at multiple time series, you're essentially eliminating the possibility of feedback relations. So you don't want to do that when you're fooling with time series. We do especially manipulations that tend to make variables more Gaussian, spatial smoothing, and then when we build a cluster, a ROI, we define a variable for it, say by taking the means or taking principal components. You're essentially making the variables more Gaussian. If you do that, it makes it convenient for lots of data analysis, lots of statistical estimation methods, but you essentially cut out the possibility of one of the most powerful search methods we have, namely the Lin-Gan algorithms, which depend on those higher order moments of the distribution that arise in non-Gaussian variables. My collaborator, Steve Hansen, who with Russ has taught me what little I know about brains and fMRI and are responsible for all that I don't know. They should have taught me more. He believes in exhaustive testing. Steve Hansen has a paper in which he exhaustively tests all the models with five variables. That was the paper from which my earlier example was taken for. That's a pretty good strategy as long as you don't have many variables. But you get to eight variables, you're toast. You can't run it. Complexity just stops you. And that was why, it was that recognition back in the late 80s that prompted the development of search algorithms that are correct but don't have these computational limitations. Here's an error which is easy easy to make. We measure stuff, and we think the stuff we measure is reflecting latent variables indirectly. So we want to know whether A causes C through B alone, or actually whether X causes Z through Y alone, or whether there's a direct effect between X and Z. And what we do is we regress C on A and B, and we ask whether the partial regression coefficient for A is significant. Now, well, that's a fallacious method. And in fact, unless B is a perfect measure of the latent variable, the unrecorded variable Y, that procedure will produce a spurious edge, a spurious dependency. It's a widely used procedure. It's really most unfortunate. Tor and I were trading stories earlier on. This is what my daughter, for her doctorate in epidemiology, was required to do, the fallacious procedure. After 9/11, I had a whole series of military guys with money wanting to know how they could find bad guys from computers, and one was a Beltway Bandit group that was sure it knew how to do it. Yes, and the way they were going to discover all the relations between bad guy variables was they were going to do exactly this fallacious thing. When I asked them what they would do about false positives, they said, "Never mind." I'm not making this up. Some errors that are not so obvious. Regression. In regression, we're essentially, well, there are lots of forms of regression: logistic, linear, polynomial, the grandmothers. But they all share something. They identify an outcome variable, and they have a set of prediction variables. Yeah? And if, in fact, you just want to do classification, nothing wrong with it. But over and over in economics and elsewhere, regression is used as a method of causal inference. That is to say, we're going to identify which of these potential causes really affect the outcome variable and by how much. And the regression estimates are always an estimate of the association of one of the prediction variables conditional on all the others. You are always, when you get, for example, when you do a linear regression, you get that beta value that comes out in your printout. What you are getting is a number that is proportional, given the variances, to a partial correlation controlling for all the other variables. That's what you're doing. You're conditioning on all the other variables. And conditioning, when you're doing causal inference, is a touchy matter that you have to be careful about lest you produce fallacies. So let's just take a standard linear model where we've got a set of variables V, measured regressors X, and latent variables T. We've got a regression equation, and what we really want to estimate is a causal influence. We want to estimate what would happen if, per impossible perhaps, but hypothetically, we were able to get in and wiggle an X and hold all the other guys constant and see what would happen to Y. Yeah? And we want to estimate that from this regression equation. So what we really want to know is when beta I is the same as BI. Well, let's look at some of the cases where it isn't. The obvious one is when there's an unrecorded common cause of the X and the Y. Then the regression coefficient is going to be right. Cause and effect are confused. Friston says one region with a long hemodynamic latency could cause a neural response in another that was expressed hemodynamically before the source. I apologize for the British spelling. So you've misestimated which is the cause and which is the effect. And of course, if you make that mistake, you can make a bunch of others. Suppose you think that xi causes y when it actually goes the other way, and you've measured xk as well. Then when you look at the xky association, you are conditioning on xi. When you do this regression, you're conditioning on xi. That means between xk and y, you're conditioning on a collider. Remember, if you condition on colliders, you create an association. So you will find a significant regression coefficient, given the sample size is large enough, between xk and y in this case, even though there's no causal connection whatsoever. The SCI algorithm, by the way, and others like it, don't make error 3. So here's an example where SCI, for example, will not mislead you and will give you correct information, where regression just screws you up. X2 and X3 are confounded by an unreported variable. X3 and Y are confounded by an unreported variable. There's no direct X3 Y influence. There's no X2 Y influence. The X1 is actually the only cause. But the regression procedure, standard regression procedures, will tell you beta 1, beta 2, beta 3 are all significant if your sample size is large enough. And only beta 1 actually corresponds to an actual cause. All of the search algorithms I talked about previously in the machine learning literature get this case right. Finally, let me talk about Granger causality. Granger causality, attributed to Clive Granger, who won the Nobel Prize for this, amongst other things, a few years back. Granger's idea was that suppose you've got time series and you want to see whether one time series variable influences another. Yeah? What you do is you see whether from this guy you can forecast values of that guy better than if you just know the previous history of that guy. And of course you can do it with multivariate time series by controlling for the other guys. So you're effectively doing a multiple regression on time series. And it can be generalized to nonlinear systems. He required stationarity, but he observed that it could be avoided with slightly different tests, and so on. Now, I find in fMRI data that this is, well, quite a lot of places. People use Granger causality in fMRI research to try to infer causal relation, if not routinely, certainly commonly and recently. And there are some minor problems, or some obvious problems. One is that it can mislead if the series is badly non-stationary. I won't go into the details. And of course, if you measure things wrong, things can always go awry. Priston notes another problem. Suppose, in fact, because hemodynamic responses can differ in their latency in different regions of the brain, what you record, if you record in one place later than in another place, the actual causal events might have their time order reversed. And so he says using Granger causality is just a mistake unless you've got the time order right for sure. Now, that's actually a problem with regression. That problem doesn't apply if you specify the structural bar models by the machine learning algorithms I talked about. Why? Because they don't assume a time order. They don't assume a time order. And we've done lots of simulations where GES, for example, gets the relations between the time series right when you give it false information about the time order. So Friston's right, but he's right about the wrong methods. Standard methods, but not the right ones. The other problem with Granger causality and time series is that the sampling rate with fMRI is slower than the causal processes.
Yeah? And your data, the sampling rate is what, every 2 seconds? Yeah? And I assume, you know, little bits of brain are talking to other little bits of brain a bit faster than that. Yeah? Well, if there are time steps in a process that aren't observed, so you only see outside the box but not inside the box, and you apply Granger causality, you get the wrong causal relations. Now I left off a spurious edge here, but you get true relations, but you also get extra relations that are false, just because you left stuff out. And I won't go through the mechanisms, but it's just an application of Perl's deseparation. Now, Granger and a colleague, Norman Swanson, realized there was a problem with sampling rates, and so they proposed a solution. The solution was you regress out the ancestors, you literally apply a regression to the time series, and then you look at the residuals. And he applied a rather limited search technique that I and my colleagues had developed in the 80s, but Nemiroff and Hoover and others have since generalized and applied PC and GES to the residuals like this in Granger causal time series. You get the same fallacious results. You get these gratuitous edges. It doesn't help. So let me conclude. Causal inference from imaging data is about as hard as it gets. You don't know whether you got the right variables. The variables you've got are proxies for what you hope are the right variables. You don't know whether the system is linear or nonlinear. You either don't know what the distribution is or you make it Gaussian. I have worked on all kinds of problems. This is the hardest problem I've ever. So interesting. I mean, this is where, if you're interested in statistics and causality, fMRI is where you want to work because it's really hard. The conventional statistical procedures are just radically insufficient. There's lots of unused principal tools in the machine learning literature. The measurement methods and the data transformations that you do can make things worse very easily. And there is, at least for thinking about the consequences of what you're doing and the alternatives, graphical causal models are the best tool we have at the time. But there aren't any magic wands, and there isn't any pixie dust. And I want to leave you with the only thing you should jot down. You won't remember much of this lecture, and that's probably for the best. But you should remember these references, because I hope at least I've piqued your interest, and the next time you have a summer vacation, you'll take with you causation, prediction, and search. Causality, skip the trash novel. The Uncertainty in Artificial Intelligence annual proceedings are online. They are a wealth of results of the kinds I've reviewed and more. The Journal of Machine Learning Research is an online journal. It is now the best journal in artificial intelligence. It was formed when computer scientists rebelled against I think it was Springer, but in any case. Peter Spurdy's webpage contains interesting, valuable papers. Today, Perl's webpage is a wealth of resources about graphical causal models. And finally, if you actually want to try all the algorithms I described, one or two are maybe still being hacked up, are online, they're freeware. They have a graphical user interface. It's ill-documented, but if you play around a bit, it's obvious. The Tetrad webpage, and just type in my name and Tetrad, and it'll take you to it somewhere in Google. Thank you very much.
for some questions.
Is much known about the small sample behavior of these algorithms? Because you talked about their behavior in the live sample.
Yeah, right. So, first the bad news. The bad news is there's a theorem. And the theorem says for normal variables, yes, and linear systems, while you can test any model for a search, yes, you can't get, as it were, a confidence interval for the search itself. It doesn't exist. Mathematically, it doesn't. It's not a practical problem, just it ain't there. So what you can do is simulations. Yeah? You can do simulations for a whole lot of cases. And you can also adapt the methods. There's a book and associated papers by a biologist in Canada, Bill Shipley. His book is called Cause and Correlation in Biology. And Shipley has, in that book and elsewhere, done a lot to look at small sample variants of these algorithms and tested them extensively. But, you know, frankly, the best thing you want to do is check sensitivity, that is to say, fool around with the parameters using a Bayesian method. You want to fool with the priors. If you're using a search like PC, you want to see if the results are robust under variations of your statistical decisions. So you could adapt. We haven't done any work on it. I mean, my colleague Larry Wasserman is an expert on false discovery rates, and you could try that. You'd have to trace the sequence of conditional independence tests you made, for example.
Yeah. Morris.
You asked why LingGAN was not used for fMRI data.
That's right.
You asked why LingGAN was not used for fMRI.
Yeah.
So LingGAN has two components. So the first thing is to do the ICA, and then you look for sparsity in the
that's right.
And
exactly.
You sort, and then you try to identify the components with the observations. So
yeah.
I think the last step is a big leap of faith.
I'm sorry?
It's a big leap to make this identification. So of course ICA.
Well, there are actually several leaves. It's more like stepping stones, right? Which one did you have in mind?
So that's the last one is sort of identifying what are the observations with the cause.
Oh.
It
isn't that simple. What you actually do is a pruning algorithm for statistical significance.
Absolutely.
Right? And you're right, that's the most sensitive part of the procedure. But I would be troubled by the linearity assumption.
Yes.
But, you know, here's the thing. See, you're perfect, right? So you come to a community, right? They're using an assumption all over the place. Yes? Linearity. Now, there are two things you can say as a critic, yes? One thing you can say is, why that assumption? The other thing is that if you're going to make that assumption, yeah, here's a better way to use it. So it seems to me LingGAN has certainly worth exploring with fMRI. We've never used it on fMRI data. We've done these more conventional methods and range of causality and come to disappointing conclusions about them one way or another. Yes. I'm sorry.
No, as you say, we have time for one more question, which will be Taurus.
All right. Well, you mentioned some of the problems with pooling time series data across subjects, for example. And most of us care about making inferences, about populations from group fMRI data, including these methods.
And you're not writing autobiography, right?
Well, so my question is: have there been any development of multi-level applications, or essentially multi-subject? Applications where you have tens of subjects.
There have. So I'm not sure this will make any sense to you, but I'll try. We actually looked at some of the Tom et al. Data from 2005, which is a series where people are essentially given various stimulus, so they're given gambles, and they respond, accept or reject, etc. And there are 8 regions of interest, and we've got 3 runs for each subject, and I've gotten 16 subjects, something like that. And of course you want to make an inference across the subject. Now, how can you do that? The GES algorithm, that Bayesian algorithm, basically here's what it does. It starts with an arbitrary graph, actually an empty graph, and asks, okay, which edge will give me the biggest likelihood for the data? Yeah? So here's what you can do. You go to U in your time series and say, which edge? Yeah? You're the biggest guy for the data. And you give me, yeah? And now we go to him, we do the same thing. Him, we do the same thing. We can either take votes over your respective edges, or we can actually look at the, we can weight them by the likelihood you assign. Yeah? Because we've assumed flat priors. Yeah? So without pooling the data, we can get a collective estimate for which edge we ought to add at any point. And then we proceed in that same way. So we've essentially, on the assumption there is a common structure, we can build a common structure without pooling the data and without running afoul of Yule's problem.
Is there a reference for that?
Never published it. Too easy.
Well, let's thank Clark again.